From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away this week. On today's show, KU students will have a lot more options with the new curriculum next year.
We have a whole lifetime, and we're not going to be able to learn all we should learn in our entire lifetime. So when you look at what should happen during 4 years of college, that's why we went through this prioritization exercise.
A local bishop and the National Catholic Reporter go head-to-head.
Catholic Church right now is in a very newsworthy situation, I guess I could say it that way. There's a lot of turmoil in the church right now.
And get a preview of a new collection of old medical paraphernalia in Shawnee.
Here are various medicine bags just for interest. This one is made from a skunk.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Starting in the fall, basic curriculum requirements will change for undergraduates at the University of Kansas. As of now, each school, whether it's the School of Health Professions or the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, has its own requirements. And some are pretty extensive and specific. Everyone has to take the same basic math or Western Civilization class, for example. But the new core curriculum doesn't require specific courses. It allows students to take a wider range that meet six overall goals. Last week, I spoke to KU's provost to hear how this will change teaching and learning at the school. But first, I talked to some KU undergrads about what they think of the current course requirements.
I'm Matt from Political Science. I don't know. Some of them are fun. I liked languages mostly, but not like math and science. That's why I went towards what I did. There's actually this one, Math 105, or something like that, I think. Introduction to Math Topics. I needed to graduate. It's the last class.
I'm Anna Kirchhoff. I'm an international studies major in French, and so far I've taken only humanities and French courses. I don't know how taking physics or like chemistry or astrology is going to help me with international studies. However, I understand that it's important to be well-rounded. Maybe I'll like one of them and change my career path, but I know myself well enough that right now, no.
I'm Aaron Ellis, and I'm an aerospace engineer major. So I'm focused a lot on math and science department, and I don't think there's anything wrong with doing some variety and getting some other classes out there, communications, working on the speaking skills, history, just knowing about the world, sociology, psychology, anything about the human behavior, anything like that is good. So I think maybe less specific isn't always bad.
It's Brian Fairchild, and yeah, I had to take a linguistics course. That's one that comes to mind, and like theater. I had to take theater as well, so those were interesting. They were fun, but didn't really apply to neurobiology.
My name is Kyrillos Andros Hanna. My major is petroleum engineering, and I'm a senior. The classes I took, social science, humanities, and advanced English, I don't know why I have to take that. I would rather take engineering classes than like humanities or social science.
I'm in the arts major, and sometimes it's hard going through a math class or a science class, but eventually you come out knowing stuff that you find you end up needing to know later.
I'm Jamie Bessie. I'm a sophomore in theatrical design. I had to take some classes that's like, oh, I wish I could have taken this different religion or this different humanities course, but I was stuck in the big lectures of 500 people because it was a requirement to take philosophy 100 instead of a cool 200 level philosophy that would have been more towards my interests.
Change may not come fast enough for these current KU students, but the new core curriculum responds to Jamie Bessie's desire for more options. While on campus, I sat down with University of Kansas Provost Jeff Vitter to hear more about the shift. He said the new core curriculum is about teaching a way of thinking.
Our KU core curriculum is focused not on specific courses or facts that we want students to learn, but it's all based around six educational goals, and they comprise a total of 12 outcomes. And those outcomes convey a whole set of skills, ways of looking at information and processing it that prepare students not only to thrive in today's technological world, but to have the foundation so that they can adapt and lead tomorrow's changing environment.
So before this change, each school had its own set of core requirements.
Can you explain what those requirements were like? And I know they're still in effect this year. The core curriculum goes into effect next year.
That's right. Well, there's no simple way to describe them all because we have 10 academic schools in the college. The most, I would say, onerous set of requirements was the set of BA requirements in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. There were 72 credit hours required, which is way beyond what any of our peers do. And they were very prescriptive. And unfortunately, to me, what they ended up having the effect of doing was to prevent students from taking advantage of the truly unique opportunities that KU offers. And that's what we're really working on with the new KU core, to let students do study abroad, to encourage them to do research, to do internships, and have a whole set of experiential opportunities such as service learning that make a difference and make education come alive. It can change your life.
What were some of the classes that in the arts and sciences that everyone had to take?
There were a two-semester sequence of courses in, for example, Western civilization, which many students will continue to take, but that particular set is not required. The same with particular sets of writing courses and oral speaking courses. It really varies by the school as far as what was required because every school had their own set of requirements.
What overall prompted the university to change the core?
What really convinced me that this was important was we had a set of requirements, but there was no link to an overarching rationale. We actually had, if you have these little white rulers that were circulated, we had a set of learning outcomes, but there was no effort, successful effort, that actually linked those outcomes to an actual curriculum. So I wanted to start at the basics and make sure that we first ask the important question, what are we trying to do with our education? What do we want students to absolutely have? And let that drive the rest of then what is required in the curriculum.
And how big of a change is this?
Well, it's a big change in that our curriculum does not require specific courses. It requires certain outcomes. And we have options to meet those outcomes. So far, roughly 500 courses have been approved to meet one or more of outcomes. We have another 400 or so in the pipeline. So very soon we'll have about 1,000 courses that meet various components of this KU core, offering students options on how they're going to meet the different requirements. And the unique thing is that we're not necessarily only requiring courses to meet outcomes. Students can satisfy the learning outcomes through study abroad or experiential learning like research or internships.
Just to summarize, the new core curriculum has 6 overall goals that students need to take courses to meet, like one is critical thinking and quantitative literacy. That's kind of a math and data goal. Another is communication, which encompasses writing and speaking. Another is breadth of knowledge. Another, culture and diversity. And also social responsibility and ethics and integration and creativity. Can you explain how the administration came up with these 6 goals? It must have been a pretty contentious conversation.
Oh, there's never contention within a university. No, what we did because exactly of that issue, and in fact, this is something that pervades the entire strategic plan, it was extremely important that we do this with bottom-up input, that we have every faculty member, staff, and student have the opportunity for direct input. We had every department, we asked them to meet and put forward suggestions for what learning goals and outcomes there should be. Once we had this huge list, and then we kind of combined different ways of wording the same idea, we asked those same departments meet and determine for us the priorities of those goals and outcomes. And there was remarkable consensus of what came to the top in terms of the important educational goals.
And now the professors are going back and maybe retooling their courses so that they can be part of the core curriculum?
Yes, that's right. Many courses already satisfy the outcomes, and it's just a matter of verifying that through an application process. Other courses will be posed as potential contributors are possibly modified so that they do meet the outcomes of the KU core.
And I imagine that that changes maybe the landscape in terms of some departments now having an opportunity to attract more students where they didn't because they weren't part of the core previously.
Exactly. And I think it's good at a university that we should always have new things happening. And this is an opportunity to relook at our courses. So many of the courses that were stalwarts previously will continue to be major courses. Other new ideas may come forward. And that's a very healthy thing in academics.
And I understand in terms of cultural diversity, there is one of the goals is culture and diversity. Mm-hmm. That means that certain courses will count towards the core that that in the past were not thought of as core. As you said before, Western civilization is kind of a classic in many universities, but now it doesn't have to be Western civilization to meet a history or a literature requirement.
That's right. That particular educational goal has two components. One that is focused on diversity within the United States, understanding our historical origins and the challenges and opportunities that we face with a multi-ethnic population. The other cultural global understanding piece has to do with overseas, which is a crucial aspect of today's world where global is becoming more and more a driving force in business and economics and society. And giving students that opportunity to understand and work with other cultures is just a tremendous learning experience.
And I wonder what's behind the idea of this goal of social responsibility and ethics. What types of courses help students meet those outcomes?
Well, if you pick up a random newspaper or listen to a radio broadcast, I think you're probably going to get the impression that it's a good thing for us to be more grounded in social responsibility and ethics. And I think in today's world, we're challenged in those areas. And the more that we can go back to what we really should be doing for the right reasons and understanding our responsibilities as a nation and as a member of a world community, that's a very positive thing. And the more that we can promote that, I think we're going to create better citizens of this world. And ultimately, it will strengthen our nation.
What kind of courses would contribute to that?
Well, in social responsibility and ethics, there are basic ethics courses, but there are a whole set of opportunities, such as perhaps involving service learning, where students would be working in the community, applying their knowledge in a way that really reinforces what they learn in the classroom in a way that they could not get from a classroom alone.
This is Casey Currents on KCUR. We're speaking with University of Kansas Provost Jeffrey Vitter about the new core curriculum, which goes into effect next school year. Now, does this echo a trend at other universities? Are other universities looking at revamping their core curricula?
Several universities have done that, but I like to think that KU has done it the best way, the right way, and that's by this outcomes-focused approach. But generally, there have been universities that over the course of time, revise what they do. And what's rewarding to me is that we're already getting calls from other places who want to learn about what we've done and copy it because of the really good things that they've seen come out of KU.
Defenders of the old core curriculum might say that there's still a value in requiring all students to take specific courses like algebra or Western civilization, and that there are certain things that all educated people should know, certain books that everyone should read. What do you think about that idea?
Well, frankly, we have a whole lifetime, and we're not going to be able to learn all we should learn in our entire lifetime. So when you look at what should happen during 4 years of college, that's why we went through this prioritization exercise. There are so many important things that would be great if students could experience them. We want to make sure they have the basics, because they're going to be changing careers multiple times in their lifetime. They're going to be living for many, many decades, and we want to give them the foundation for how to learn, because you cannot finish an education. It's just a starting project. And I'm really excited about this KU core because it gives students that basic from which they can then go out and they know how to learn, and they will be learning their entire lifetimes.
there's also the idea that having so many options might make it easier for students to kind of pick and choose whatever the easiest way towards a degree is.
Well, I look at it a different way, and that is that options will give students an opportunity to experiment, to go into areas that they may have been afraid of going into before, or possibly handicapped because of so many requirements. Those areas could end up their majors, they may not, but students will gain valuable skills. They will double major, they will have minors, they will take on certificates, and they will put together unique sets of courses that may not correspond to any formal program, but will give them, in their individual way, an important background for them to go on from graduation and do good things in life. And that's what we're about here.
KU Provost Jeff Vitter, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Nice talking with you, Sylvia.
Coming up, the bishop tells the National Catholic Reporter to remove the word Catholic from its name. Hear the editor's response. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away this week. Two lightning rods of controversy in the Catholic community clashed recently when Kansas City's Bishop Robert Finn publicly denounced the locally based National Catholic Reporter. Back in the fall, Bishop Finn, who's head of the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese, was convicted of failing to report suspected child abuse. The reporter called for his resignation. Now, the bishop says the paper's anti-church editorials have gone too far, and the reporter should stop calling itself Catholic. This week, Casey Currents' Alex Smith spoke with the National Catholic Reporter's editor about the controversy and about covering a beat that doesn't always welcome a critical eye.
In the mid-1960s, the National Catholic Reporter broke away from the local diocese paper and established itself as an objective, independent newspaper reporting on the Catholic world. The reporter quickly drew criticism from the church for its coverage of civil rights issues as well as its critical editorials and investigative reporting. In 1967, the reporter published leaked documents from the Vatican describing an internal debate over birth control. They revealed that the majority of the Pope's theologians believed that the church should change its teaching. National Catholic Reporter editor Dennis Cody believes this was a great moment for the paper.
It was a watershed in Catholic journalism because it was an internal document, and it revealed the debate that was going on. And it was something that had not been seen in the Catholic Church before. Even with, you know, all the reporting that had gone on in religious press and secular press from the Vatican Council, which was extensive at that time period, this was a new level. This had brought it to a new level.
A year later, when the Pope upheld the rejection of birth control, the National Catholic Reporter issued an editorial criticizing the decision. Local Bishop Charles Helmsing was not pleased.
Bishop Helmsing condemned the paper, asked us to remove Catholic from the name. That was reported very extensively within the Reporter. The letter from Helmsing was printed in full. There was response back from the board of directors who acknowledged the letter and studied it seriously, but after that study said that we are an independent publication. We're not an official organ of the church. And so therefore, we don't need to follow the guidelines that he had spelled out. And therefore, we could still remain Catholic in that sense.
In recent years, the National Catholic Reporter has continued to raise the ire of the church and many followers. Especially in the past year, the National Catholic Reporter's editorials have hit on some of the Catholic world's most controversial topics. In the spring, the paper endorsed an Australian bishop's call for the church to re-examine its teachings on sexuality. In a November editorial, the paper called for the ordination of women. And most significantly, at least to many local Catholics, is the editorial the paper published about Bishop Finn himself.
In September, we called for Robert Finn to resign as Bishop of Kansas City St. Joseph. And that was because in mid-September, he was convicted of a criminal misdemeanor charge of failing to report suspected child abuse. The state of Missouri calls him a mandatory reporter, and he did not fulfill that duty in the case of Father Sean Rannigan. Besides violating civil law, and he's on plea bargain deals in Jackson County and Clay County, besides violating that civil law, he also violated church law, what's commonly called the Dallas Charter, which spells out how bishops are supposed to handle sex abuse cases. He's in violation of that because of failure to report. And so because of those reasons, that's why we called for his resignation.
In his recent column, Bishop Robert Finn said the reporter had been a long-standing source of frustration for the church, and he repeated Helmzing's request that the paper stop identifying itself as Catholic. Dennis Cody acknowledges that previous local bishops have often disagreed with the reporter, but he says they've treated the paper with a reluctant acceptance. Bishops who followed Helmzing agreed to interviews, and one even blessed the paper's offices. But Finn, who became bishop in 2005, returned to the hardline stance that Helmzing voiced in 68, and he took his concerns to the paper's then-publisher, Sister Rita Larrivee.
Bishop Finn came in. He had conversations with Sister Rita where he raised a question about the use of Catholic in our name. And Sister Rita just, you know, reiterated the history that we have. Our current publisher, Tom Fox, at one point received a letter expressing concern, and Tom invited the bishop in for a conversation and discussion, and as far as I know, that never happened.
Shortly after becoming bishop, Finn also requested that the paper submit its bona fides to affirm its accordance with Catholic law. In his recent editorial, he cites canon law as it applies to journalism. Law 831 states the Christian faithful are not, unless there's just and reasonable cause, to write in newspapers, pamphlets, or periodicals which are clearly accustomed to attack the Catholic Church or good morals. But Cody says since the paper is not part of the Church, these kinds of laws don't apply.
No, because there's also a long history of freedom of the press within the Church, although it's not clearly understood. So, and I think we exercise that freedom as a media outlet, as any media outlet would have.
Finn says the paper undermines church teachings and lionizes dissident theologies. Cody responds that the paper has no anti-church agenda. It simply addresses issues as they arise in the church.
We report stories that come to us, you know, and the Catholic Church right now is in a very newsworthy situation, I guess I could say it that way. There's a lot of turmoil in the church right now. And that is reflected in our pages.
The reporter currently has a circulation of about 35,000, and its website receives about 300,000 unique visitors a month. Despite being one of the biggest national Catholic news outlets, the reporter is not so popular with many dioceses. Cody says that some bishops have standing orders forbidding diocese members from speaking with the paper. While the relationship with Bishop Finn has complicated things for the paper, conflict with the church is nothing new.
I take the analogy of the local daily newspaper or radio station that reports on City Hall, and the mayor's got his finger in the till. You know, there's going to be resistance there. The mayor's going to have his own supporters that are going to be denigrating the paper and the media coverage and saying it's unfair. Same thing happens with us. If we report on a bishop, the bishop has his own supporters, and they're going to be saying that, you know, we're unfair or we're biased or we're pushing our own agenda. Or, because we're a church publication, we're violating church law. And I think that's silly. That's nonsense. I mean, especially in the United States, with a long tradition of press freedom, that's what we do. We take the tools of journalism and we use that to shine light into the Catholic Church. That's our mission, that's our mandate, and that's what we do.
Editor Dennis Cody says the National Catholic Reporter has no plans to change its name or its mission. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
As extreme weather like flooding and drought takes land out of production in the Midwest, farmers and ranchers also are getting record prices for their products. So you might think that that wouldn't bode well for conservation efforts. But as it turns out, some landowners are still managing to set land aside for environmental uses. Reporting from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media, Hillary Stowes Krause explains.
Along the winding road to and through Gracie Creek Ranch, a 25,537-acre yearling cattle ranch in central Nebraska, there are no houses in sight. No buildings, for that matter. Just acres and acres of gold and amber grass, punctuated by patches of sand and lines of barbed wire fence. And that's the way the owners of Gracie Creek Ranch want it to stay.
I was so excited to hear about this opportunity, and I mean, I thought that probably everybody would want to be doing this.
That's Lindsay Price, a fourth-generation rancher who owns Gracie Creek Ranch with her father Bob and brother Aaron. The opportunity she's talking about is a conservation easement. The Prices recently sold the largest such easement in Nebraska history, covering more than 40 square miles. The easement will be overseen by the Nebraska Environmental Trust. Funding came from private, state, and federal sources.
We're basically giving up some rights to farm and drill and wind development and
subdivision.
And subdivision. That's another huge one. To me, it gives us a chance to protect and preserve by giving up those rights.
Signing a legal contract to not develop or seek maximum production might seem counterintuitive, but in fact, for some, conservation practices have tangible economic benefits. The Prices easement, for example, was valued at nearly $1.8 million. And in a way, they're essentially being paid to keep doing what they've always done. Rich Nelson is with the Nebraska Office of the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Most often, the first one that's thought of is a financial benefit because they are obviously compensated in most cases for the value of that easement. There's always a lot of different motivations by different landowners based on what their goals are for their property.
For the Prices, a main factor was knowing their land would be protected. Bob Price explains.
You know, I said I'm third generation, been in this business a long, long time. I think one of the biggest challenges I see in the near-term future is that a lot of people are going to say production agriculture cannot coexist with conservation practices. And it really saddens me because I feel just the opposite. I just feel very, very strongly about taking care of the land.
While the Prices have sought to help the environment by limiting development, a landowner in central Nebraska did the opposite.
If you listen, there is a noise to these things.
That's Jeff Evans, who owns farmland just outside Broken Bow, Nebraska. Evans is talking about wind turbines, four of which jut out from the ground on his property. They're part of a new 14,000-acre wind farm with 50 turbines. Evans, like the Prices, says he and his wife decided to participate in large part because of concerns about the environment.
I think everyone is thinking about, you know, again, 10, 20 years from now, where's the power going to come from, right? And how are we going to generate it?
But the money doesn't hurt either, Evans says.
Of course, all of the landowners have a really nice economic benefit that comes from having them on your place.
A subsidiary of an international power company will pay the landowners a total of about $540,000 per year for the 25-year lease. But rural conservation can also come in smaller doses. While the wind turbines dominate the landscape on Evans' property, a tiny orange sign reading Corners for Wildlife Project also is significant. For fields watered by pivot irrigation, about 7 or 8 acres in every corner are out of reach of water streams and simply don't produce as well. Groups like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited pay landowners to not farm certain parts of their property. Instead, the conservation groups help them plant native grasses to create breeding habitats.
We just like to see the birds, I mean, the pheasants and the wildlife around us and stuff. So for us, it's more about the wildlife than hunting.
Those kinds of financial incentives are key to increasing conservation efforts on farmland and ranchland, says Terry DeGroff. He's an ag financial management consultant from Burwell who helped with the Gracie Creek Ranch easement.
I think in the most part it factors in significantly. They're trying to stay profitable, and it's just human nature that you think you got to take more. If there's some forage out there, you better take it or else it's going to waste. Many people, when they're struggling to make a living, are going to try to harvest as much as they can.
Still, according to environmentalists, the opportunities to capitalize on conservation may be greater than ever. And for some landowners, the conservation price is right. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hilary Stowes-Krause.
Medicine is changing pretty fast these days, with new procedures, treatments, and drugs coming out all the time. But one area doctor has been on a mission to pay homage to medicine's past, the mistakes, breakthroughs, and lessons that might be taken for granted today. Dr. Bruce Hodges started out collecting medical relics from around the region as a kind of hobby, but it's grown way beyond the confines of his house. KCUR's Alana Gordon recently caught up with Dr. Hodges for a sneak peek at his soon-to-be public collection in Shawnee.
Some people might be really into coins, or stamps, or old records. For Dr. Bruce Hodges, it's all things having to do with medicine.
These are old x-ray machines and ultrasound machines. Here are various medicine bags, just for interest. This one is made from a skunk, 1848. They're all kind of unusual. My favorites are the earmuff type hearing devices down there to collect the...
Dr. Hodges has been collecting medical memorabilia for some time.
Oh, I started this 35, 40 years ago when I had a few artifacts that were somehow or other picked up. I don't even remember. And I put them in the waiting room, and people began to say they liked it, and I began to add to it. And first thing you know, I had a pretty large collection.
So how large is your collection?
We have over 5,000 artifacts now.
Dr. Hodges is 80 years old. He graduated from KU Med School in the 60s and has been practicing in the region ever since. His focus is primary care, but he moved into geriatric medicine as his patients got older. Initially, his family thought his collection was just an expensive hobby.
And then first thing you know, it had such a collection that it began to have meaning.
Hodges says about 10 years ago, he and his family reached a turning point. He'd been displaying some of the items around town, but the collection had gotten really big. Too big. They reached a point, either sell everything or go all out.
This is a new museum which is being developed, Medicine's Hall of Fame and Museum in Shawnee, Kansas.
Hodges and his family have put everything, their life savings, into vamping up this collection. They've spent the last several months preparing to open up this museum. Hodges says it's been a dream of his for over a decade.
It was just a matter of finding the right moment, the right building, the right timing in our lives, and this seemed to be it.
What is this space? What did it used to be? It seems kind of like it's got some kind of old, like, 70s feel, a lot of wooded paneling, like it might have been, you know, an old lodge restaurant.
Actually, this was an old motorcycle showroom, Harley-Davidson, and this actually was the showroom for the motorcycles, and back the next section was the parts department, and then there was the workshop behind that. The building is 15,000 square feet.
The whole place is loosely organized through medical themes that Hodges has parsed out by region and time. There's a Native American section that features things like a healing drum used by a secret society of the Chippewa tribe in the late 1800s. There's an entire display just focused on smallpox,
which was still very deadly, even in the United States in the 60s. When we had 60 and 70,000 cases of it, and 80% of those people died. But when immunizations came along and people got vaccinated or they got shots for typhoid fever, we began to wipe those diseases out. And smallpox is a perfect example of how diseases can be eradicated, not just in the United States, but from the face of the earth.
Turn on the light.
Let's start in here.
Hodges takes me to a separate room where he has two of his most valued items, iron lungs.
This is like a chamber, and it's about 2 feet, 2.5 feet in diameter. It's about 6.5 feet long.
The antiquated respirators helped keep paralyzed polio patients alive and breathing in the 1950s. This iron lung is a soft yellow color. There's a mannequin in it.
The pressure would be built up by this machine, and as the pressure increased inside of the tube, it would press on the chest and force you to breathe out, exhale. Then it would create a vacuum and lift the chest. And it did that 18 times a minute. The average life expectancy in here was 9 years.
9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So do you remember seeing people in these when you went to the hospital?
Yes. When I was a teenager, I was hospitalized at General Hospital in Kansas City, and they had many of these units, a whole ward full of them.
Hodges says polio vaccines, which he used to administer, have mostly gotten rid of the disease. And it's artifacts like this iron lung that he says bring to life medicine's past and significant developments. There's one other part of the museum that Hodges says brings all these themes together.
Another room. Oh, there's another room.
You can see we're still developing. This is going to be what we call a Hall of Fame.
This space will entirely be devoted to people who've contributed to medicine over the years. People like Ignaz Semmelweis, who proved the importance of washing hands in the 1850s.
Hand washing is the one thing in medicine that prevents disease more than anything else. The one thing. Dr. Semmelweis initiated a policy in the hospital that all the doctors had to wash their hands before they went in to deliver a baby. They almost kicked him out of the hospital. But when the doctors were made to wash their hands,
the death rate also dropped from 33% to 3% on the doctor's ward.
Also featured is Christian Barnard, who did the first heart transplant. And then there's Sir Alexander Fleming, who invented penicillin. Hodges said without him, he wouldn't be here today. As a kid, Hodges came down with what would have been a fatal illness. But luckily for him, he says he was one of the first patients to gain access to penicillin. Hodges hopes the importance of these and other developments will come to life through his collection once the museum opens, and that others will come to appreciate the history of medicine as much as he does. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Dr. Bruce Hodges Medicine Museum and Hall of Fame opens in Shawnee at the end of this month. In the meantime, you can test how well your own medical trivia knowledge matches that of Dr. Hodges in a quiz online at kcur.org. You can also check out some photos of the iron lung and other artifacts on display at the museum. If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Composer Kirk Meacham has written more than 250 works, from choral music to operas. Meacham's lived in San Francisco for decades, but he grew up in Topeka and says he still considers himself a Midwesterner.
The old saying that you can take the boy out of Kansas, but you can never take Kansas out of the boy.
Meacham visited the University of Kansas in Lawrence recently to talk to students and attend performances of Tartuffe, the first opera he wrote. He told KCUR's Laura Spencer that he was an English major at Stanford, but a class in harmony changed his career path.
That was the what they call the defining moment, right? When I took harmony, and it was just so much fun and so easy for me. It just was, you know, I couldn't wait for the next assignment. And it just so happened that the first teacher I had was the choral director. And he made everybody in his classes sing in the chorus. And that just opened up a whole new world to me. Because I never sung in a chorus. I never sung in it, never played in an orchestra. And to hear all these wonderful melodies around me, they're all making the harmony at the same time, just for the first time really experiencing music from the inside instead of as a listener.
When you started composing music, you were focusing on choral music. And I had read that your mother was a Presbyterian and your father was an atheist. And I'm just curious how that background...
You know more about me than I do.
I'm just curious how that background informed that music. Some of that music is maybe religious in tone or theme.
Well, that's a good question, because I'm not religious myself, and yet one could with good reason ask me why I wrote a lot of music with biblical texts. It's because a lot of the Bible is wonderful poetry, and it's wonderful poetry on universal themes.
Could you talk about when you first became interested in opera? Because I'd read that you didn't hear much opera growing up, but that when you were in Vienna, that you were introduced to Mozart's operas.
Yeah, well, there was no opera in Topeka, and there was no opera in Kansas City then. I mean, the Kansas City Opera was 50 years old in 2008. I predate that quite a bit. The only opera I had heard was my parents listened to the Metropolitan on Saturday. Every Saturday they listened to that. But you can imagine that a kid, sports-minded kid, is not going to sit down on Saturday and listen to people singing in a language he hasn't any idea about. When I went to Vienna to live, and I really learned German well enough to understand, particularly the Mozart operas, given in smaller halls, And in those days, 1956, there weren't tourists there. It was just the year after the Russians had left. And so the only people going to these operas were native Viennese, and they were laughing at all the jokes and just having the best time. That's when I finally realized what opera was and could be.
That you're invited to speak and visit universities. Is there something that people often ask you about?
Oh, I think the best advice is what Oscar Wilde gave, and that is to always be yourself, because everybody else is already taken. And that would be my advice, too. Composition is really saying what is your personality, your character, your taste, your experiences. And those are only yours. Everybody does it their own way, and that's the way it should be.
Composer and Kansas native Kirk Meacham spoke to KCUR's Laura Spencer. Find out more about his life and music on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture. After the break, local composers are merging acoustic and electronic sounds. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is out this week. In area news, Kansas moved towards changing the way Supreme Court members are appointed. The philanthropist some called Kansas City's First Lady died, and the GM Fairfax plant announced a sizable expansion. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
General Motors CEO Dan Akerson announced the company's $600 million investment in the Fairfax plant.
That's one of the largest single plant investments in one plant in GM's history, other than a greenfield new plant.
There was no mention of adding more jobs at the assembly plant, which now employs more than 3,700. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback's agenda rolled ahead. The state Senate passed a proposal to have the governor appoint appellate and state Supreme Court judges, to then be confirmed by the Senate. They're currently nominated by a panel composed mostly of attorneys, which Republicans like Senator Jeff King say is undemocratic.
We are faced with a system that puts unprecedented power in the hands of one special interest group.
Democrats, including Topeka's Anthony Hensley, say the current system is about appointing qualified judges.
The judiciary branch is the last remaining branch of a government free from Governor Brownback's control.
The bill now goes to the Kansas House. A constitutional amendment, it would also require a public vote. The Kansas House passed a bill prohibiting payroll deductions for public employee union political contributions. Republican Marvin Klebb of Overland Park said it was about protecting workers.
This is giving them the opportunity to avoid contributing to political action committees that they don't want to contribute to.
Democratic Representative John Wilson was among those who didn't agree.
HB 2023 is an overtly political attempt to fix a problem that doesn't exist.
The NEA's David Schommer had similar thoughts on a bill in committee that would limit the bargaining rights of teachers' unions.
This bill's unspoken interest is to get rid of collective bargaining as we know it in Kansas.
In his State of the State address, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon again called for the expansion of Medicaid in the state.
Will we let the tax dollars that Missourians send to Washington be spent in other states instead? The people of Missouri deserve to see their tax dollars come back to their communities.
Republican House and Senate majorities were not buying that. Nixon also asked for more education spending, a longer school year, and campaign contribution limits. Kansas City, Missouri law enforcement agencies joined forces as the No Violence Alliance. Coordinator Captain Joe McHale said it will focus on about 360 individuals at the core of violent crime.
In the coming weeks, key individuals in these violent networks will be contacted and a clear message will be delivered. The message will be, we are here to help.
Kansas City recorded the most January homicides in 20 years. And the city lost the woman who some called its first lady. Adele Hall was the first woman president of the Area United Way, chaired the boards of Children's Mercy Hospital and the Greater Kansas City Community Foundation, and supported hundreds of area causes and charities. Mayor Sly James said,
we've lost a person who was a friend, who was a patron of the arts, who was involved in a lot of different aspects of this city. And I have to tell you, I was a little bit stunned and still am.
Adele Hall is survived by her husband of nearly 60 years, Donald Hall, and two sons, a daughter and nine grandchildren. This is KCUR.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of playwright William Inge. His classic plays like Bus Stop and Picnic drew on his formative years in Independence, Kansas. Inge was never openly gay, but he did write a series of short plays featuring gay characters and stories that are rarely produced. A collage of four of these plays opened this weekend, staged inside what used to be the region's premier venue for female impersonators. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
From the late 50s to 1972, the Jewel Box in the 3200 block of Troost was the place in the Midwest to take in a show by performers called Femme Mimics, later known as female impersonators, and as of late, drag queens. This month, the Jewel Box is the site of the world premiere of four little-known pieces by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and native Kansan, William Inge. Artist Joseph Keane is one of the producers of what's called An Otherwise Hopeless Evening of Very Gay and Extremely Grim Short Plays. He says he was able to connect Inge and the Jewel Box thanks to the Kansas City-housed Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America.
The collection manager over there, Stuart Hines, provided us with a plethora of information about the history of the gay bar scene in Kansas City and really narrowed down what bars possibly William Inge could have visited. He was often cited as leaving to go to the city, and so Kansas City would definitely be one of those places. And there's mention of female impersonation at one point that he had a curiosity on, and the Jewel Box Lounge was the female impersonation bar where we're sitting at right now.
Directing the show is New York-based theater artist Travis Chamberlain, whose resume includes a site-specific production of a rarely seen Tennessee Williams play staged in a Midtown Manhattan hotel room. Found first were two short plays Inge would only allow to be published after his mother's death. He and Keane then discovered two unpublished pieces in an Inge biography. Chamberlain says it was hard to resist creating a show that references both Inge's veiled sexuality and mid-20th century homosexuality in the Midwest.
Looking at this issue of struggle was fascinating, honestly. That was embedded in the material, and thinking about the way in which that struggle has changed over time and trying to create some sort of connection with Kansas City's contemporary LGBTQ community to a struggle that predates, you know, Stonewall in New York, and thinking about what is that experience here in the heartland.
One of the vignettes, called The Love Death, features a flamboyant artist who is setting up a drastic event with a series of phone calls. Chamberlain decided to interweave the character throughout the piece and have every actor in the show play him. Here, he's embodied by well-known Kansas City drag queen and late-night theater veteran Dee Dee DeVille.
God knows I would not destroy myself because of anything you might happen to write about me, Mr. Parker. Because even though you do write for a so-called intellectual magazine, I see through your prose. I consider it a compliment that you did not like my book, Mr. Parker.
Though DeVille's drag queen credentials post-date the Jewel Box, he says performing there now has a historic resonance.
I was always one that was very interested in our history as a queen, and, you know, even in acting and stuff. So I'd heard of the Jewel Box.
So, I mean, there's just
something sort of surreal and special about being able to do something that you love in a place that has such great history about those that came before that made, you know, what I do possible.
Despite all the evidence to the contrary, William Inge never publicly acknowledged that he was gay, but the fact that the William Inge estate gave this production permission to stage these plays may lend that idea some tacit acceptance. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
An otherwise hopeless evening opened this weekend in the former home of the Jewel Box at 32nd and Troost and runs through February 17th. We end today's show with some sounds from a show that's happening tonight at the Gallery La Esquina. The Kansas City Electronic Music and Arts Alliance performs concerts related to the artwork at that venue. The exhibition on display is called Composite Structures and deals with the intersection of art and architecture. We're listening to a piece by Luke Russell called Snare a Space, where a simple snare drum is played live. The sound is processed electronically and emerges from speakers placed throughout the room, the intersection of acoustics and architecture. And here's a preview of Simon Fink's improvisation modules, performed by Eric Honor on saxophone and manipulated live by Fink on his laptop. New performances of these pieces are part of a program called Hybrid Structures, tonight at 7:30 at La Esquina. Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org. You can hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents. Casey Currents' associate producers are Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky and Zach Lewandowski. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson will be back with me next week.